your answers, okay. And then we'll leave an opportunity for questions.
Okay. The two questions I had, the first one was, who is the client? For our purposes, what we typically use as a guiding principle is who's going to be able to respond to our recommendations. Who do we send the engagement letter to? And that is our client. And as I point out, a couple of examples from constitutional and statutory sources that in the case of Measure 66 would be all the agencies that are receiving a lot of refunds would be the ones we engage and treat as our client or our oddity. And then for the Senate Bill 1, it would be the Oregon Youth Authority. And that's a simple answer to who is our client.
Then it would safely be it's never the legislature.
That would be how we would view it. Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
And the second question is what audit functions are legislatively created? And that, as I thought about it, that seemed like a pretty simple question, but it really is a pretty complicated one. And so what I attempted to do was to provide the tracking spreadsheet that we use, which is roughly 6 pages long, of all the statutes that we track that have some influence on what we do. I would group those into two major categories. One are the kind of the other duties as assigned sorts of statutes, like the hotline, which we wouldn't do unless we had a statute to that effect. And the others would be statutes that affect more the auditing work that we do, which is, if you take it up that next extra level to the constitutional level, as the auditor of public accounts, Mr. Secretary has the duty to do audits, and we view those particular statutory provisions as things that are of interest to the legislature, and that certainly if it's in statute, we would attempt to do those things and do those things. And if they weren't in statute, I suspect we would still be able to do those things. So I did provide. Yes, ma'am.
Help me with one thing. How do you enter into a situation? I understand that you have obligations in statute, mm-hmm. and you do those. Occasionally, the secretary comes into the building and asks for statutory authority to do other acts, other audits. In some cases, there may or may not be negotiations around it, and what I'm trying to get to is, and you'll have to help me with the facts here, I understand that there had been discussion about the possibility of doing K-12 audits, and as I understand it, that now is being negotiated to a voluntary, that school districts would present themselves. How will that work? Will you explain that to me?
Well, really, the issue, we clearly have the constitutional authority to audit K-12 school districts now, and we've done some. The most recent one was one that was like 12 years ago, I guess, or actually it was one more recently in Sun River, but Klamath Falls was an example of that. But the issue is how do we get audits of K-12 schools paid for. One way to get them paid for is to send a bill to the school district, which would be a very unwelcome bill in a school district because they've not planned on it. And with our state agencies, we have a fee that every agency pays every 2 years that supports the audit function, and the fee is paid not just by the agencies who are audited, but it's paid by all of state government to pay for the auditing function. So basically, the issue that we've been working on is how to get audits of K-12 schools paid for, and the proposal that is currently has moved out of past the
Ways and Means, I believe.
It's in Ways and Means. Sorry, is that there be money taken from the school support fund to support auditing of K-12 schools, and that's what is contained in the bill that's right now in the Ways and Means Committee.
Okay, so I understand the funding piece of it. Will these then be audits that you all pick, or are they negotiated with the school district, or does the school district come forward and ask for performance or a fiscal audit?
The way we are starting it is basically school districts can come forward and ask for performance audits, and that's how it's being started, to basically get school districts used to the idea of audits and that.
I got one you can start with. How about Jewel?
As long as they want to come forward, we'd be more than happy.
Let's start with Representative Crummell. We'll come back to Senator Whitson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm curious about, I have a couple of questions, but since the K-12 education one was brought up, let me just go to it first. Currently, under local budget law, all local governments, political subdivisions, et cetera, are required to do an annual audit. It's right. Supposed to be done by an independent auditor that they contract with to bring in. So if we were to give the authority to the Secretary of State's office, which you already have, as you've pointed out, constitutionally, but if we were to, in statute, give that authority to the Secretary of State's office, how would the audits be different than what is currently being done? Because one of the things that the local budget audit should be looking at is performance.
The current audits that are legally required of all municipalities are done by certified public accountants, and they are essentially financial audits. They are not performance audits. And let me just ask Chuck to describe to you the difference between the financial audits that CPAs do a great job of, and we're not trying to interfere with that at all, but there's another issue called performance auditing and effectively spending money, not just legally spending money.
Yeah. But before you start, Chuck, if I may, Madam Chair, aren't the audits that are done by the Secretary of State's office done by certified public accountants?
Some are. Chuck, you want to speak to that?
Madam Chair, Representative Crummell, we have, yes, that's true. A lot of the audits that we do are performed by certified public accountants. Typically, the performance audit side, we look for folks with a broader experience and expertise than just the CPA, who tends to be a financial auditor. We have folks that are certified. I don't know if certified isn't the right word, but hold degrees in MBAs, MPAs. Those sorts of folks that have great analytical skills, learn the tools of auditing, and then apply those sorts of skills in the performance audit arena. That's typically the sort of folks that we would look at to be a performance audit type. And in response to your municipal audit question, they are the base of those are financial audits, and we have licensed, we don't have, but there are licensed municipal auditors that do those things. But they go a little beyond financial audits as well, as I'm sure you pointed out. There are some other compliance requirements. They're supposed to look at the ADM calculations at the local level. So it goes a little beyond a financial audit. There are some other compliance issues that the licensed municipal auditors are asked to look at when they're doing an audit of a locality.
So in the... If I may, Mr. Chair? Thank you. So with regards to the education audits, are you going to actually have somebody that has a background in education helping with those audits?
Chair Jensen, Representative Crummell, we have done some education work already. I mean, I think if you go out and look at our website, we've done several projects that started with the Department of Education. So we have folks with some background, and I certainly wouldn't say that they're necessarily experts in education operations at this point. A lot of the things that we would be looking at school districts, the back office operations are very typical of most operations. You know, payroll and those sorts of things would be fairly standard sorts of things which we look at regularly when we audit state government. So I think a lot of those things would be transferable to the sort of work we would do at the school districts if we're looking at operations. I'm not saying there isn't a learning curve, and certainly the more we do, the better we will be, but I suspect that a lot of the sorts of things we'll be looking at would have the same sort of basis that they would in state agencies. And as we do more, I'm sure we'll learn more nuances, but I think we have a fairly good base to do those sorts of that sort of work in school districts.
So
in performance audits, is that going to include the teaching staff and the administrative staffs and how they perform and what kind of results and outcomes they're getting?
Chair Jensen, Representative Crummell, the plan is not to look at the in-classroom education results sort of issues. Our expertise is operational, and that's where we would suspect we would stay, would be on the operational side and not in the classroom side. Though, you know, they are a group of teachers, and all the back office functions we're talking about are going to be affected in some way by the activities of teachers. But in terms of measuring outcomes of education, that wouldn't be something that we would make an audit objective.
Okay. One more question, Mr. Chair? Unmarked, and it's not on this issue. It's not on the education. It's so what I'm getting from the sheet that you and the spreadsheet that you gave us, Chuck, is that you have three areas where it's constitutionally mandated, and then everything else is in statute. So I am to assume then that everything else that's in statute, if it was the will of the legislature to make a change to those, we could, and we would not be violating the Constitution. Is that correct?
Chair Jensen, Representative Krummel, I don't know if I'm qualified to answer from that point of view. As I explained initially, I'm not sure I would be qualified to answer that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krummel, I'm not a legal expert here, but it's pretty clear to me that the legislature would be free to eliminate a statutory request for an audit. Where you potentially would run into problems is if you tried to limit our audit authority through statute. That is where the Constitution and the statute run into each other. So certainly you could delete, like, for example, you created the legislature created the fraud, waste, and abuse hotline, and you could certainly eliminate that. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah.
I mean, you could certainly eliminate that, but there's nothing that you could do that. And there's nothing that would prevent us from creating something like that. I'm not saying we would, but we certainly would be able to do that.
The chair would be remiss not to observe or note that we would certainly not expect you all, without being members of the Oregon Bar Association, to be practicing law in front of a House Senate Joint Committee.
I appreciate that being part of the
tough so, but I did have one quick question, and we need to move on with this. Did I understand, as you were going through this, and I'm sorry for coming in late, but did I understand you to say that you have no municipal auditors and nobody licensed municipal auditors in the Secretary of State's office?
Chair Jensen, our municipal audit staff, it consists of one full-time audit manager and a part-time supervisor that oversee the whole program. I'm stalling here because I'm trying to remember, but they aren't licensed municipal auditors. We don't actually perform the audits. We oversee the program. We do review their work, and they are both CPAs. That's an extra endorsement.
Representative Whitson, I'll pursue this.
Thank you, Chair Jensen. Chuck, to me, a voluntary audit is as oxymoronic as an internal audit. How can an audit be voluntary? Rhetorical question. But as I'm understanding, the Secretary of State is the constitutionally the auditor of the state, of all different functions of the state. And we're kind of have a conundrum here in that no one else can be assigned to be an auditor, yet the Secretary of State doesn't have the capacity or the financial wherewithal to do the auditing. So it seems like we're running into a brick wall as far as being able to fund and to have the personnel to do school audits and to do the audits on nonprofits that you could access state funds. So does the Secretary of State's office have a plan or some type of a scheme to create the capacity to do what you're constitutionally supposed to be doing?
Chair Jensen, Senator Whitsitt, just as a general comment, you know, we always felt like we feel like we don't have enough resources to do the work that we would like to do. We are able to do what is mandated, and we certainly are doing the annual things that we absolutely need to turn out in order to keep the state running and provide the assurances we need to provide there. In terms of the school audit function, it will have to be a long-range plan. That's for sure. Initially, I would suspect that if the bill goes through as planned, we're looking at a $500,000 funding and, you know, four or five of our own auditors that will be learning and doing these audits as we proceed. We probably will engage contractors at some point when we feel like we really have an understanding of the sort of questions we're trying to answer and provide that and incorporate that as a part of our strategy. But I don't know that for certain, but just kind of thinking out loud, I would think that would be one way to extend our capacity. And then as we handle future budgets, I would suspect if we see the value, and I can convince the legislature the value, will be adding dedicated staff to this program as it grows.
Senator Johnson?
I'm sorry to keep beating this to death, but I really am struggling to understand it. Bill asks for $1 million. You just said $500,000. Explain to me how this is going to work.
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, I believe the division, and it certainly hasn't been set yet, the bill is asking for $1 million, but there are certain other things in the bill around creating the advisory commission and funding those activities, creating the best practices, and those sort of activities are going to take some of those resources off. It was really a guesstimate on my part based on the staffing we're asking for and what I think one side of the table discussion I had with the deputy of at education. So that's kind of what we're looking at. In terms of the voluntary, we'll see. You know, I don't know. I suspect that we have been assured that there'll be folks who will want to step forward and have these sorts of things done. And audit will provide assurance. You know, we'll be looking at best practices and doing the comparison, looking for economies and efficiencies. And that if they truly are interested in improving their operations, then I suspect some will step forward in that vein. We'll see. We still have the authority to do the audits. The fact that this is initially a voluntary program, I don't think is necessarily a bad thing. I think only time will tell whether we get the sort of cooperation that we would expect.
Mr. Chair,
I wasn't implying it was a bad thing. I was just asking the mechanics.
I'm sorry.
I
didn't mean to imply.
No value judgment on it at all. Okay. I just want to know how the mechanics will work, and I was just trying to get a handle on the finances and what your expectations were of how the program would work. You have a bill that's going to be before Ways and Means at some point with $1 million price tag, and I was just trying to understand the framework.
Yeah, Chair Jensen, Senator, I apologize. I was asked that other question in another hearing, and my mind just kind of went that direction out of the voluntary. There will be the commission that will help set up the best practices. The school districts that would like to be reviewed, audited, will step forward. The minute they step forward and agree, it is a performance audit, and we would do what we do around performance audits, looking at best practices and economies and efficiencies around specific areas of operation.
Senator Whitson.
Thank you, Chair Jensen. I'm still having trouble with this voluntary audit. I mean, demographically, do you suppose that those school districts who are doing very well might wish to flaunt how well they're doing, and those districts who are not doing very well might not want to flaunt how well they're not doing? To self-select an audit, to me, is just oxymoronic. I'm sorry.
Chair Jensen, Senator Whitsitt, I'm sure there's others that share that view.
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, just to be clear, our initial proposal was to do audits that would be our choice, not voluntary, but we still needed to figure out a way to get them paid for. The compromise we came to, which I'm very supportive of, is one where we have the support of the full educational community It's real clear to me that there are a number of school superintendents who really see a significant value from having performance audits done, because they see it as a great way to have someone outside of their organization come in and look at their organization and help them figure out ways to run more effectively. Best example is the current head of the Confederation of School Administrators, Jerry, I think his name is Jerry Colonna, who's from the Beaverton superintendent. He is totally enthusiastic. He will be one of the first people coming to ask for a performance audit, because he sees it as a great resource to manage his school better. So that's what, that to me is ideal, is we want to start to create a sense that this is something that school districts can benefit from and learn how to run their school districts and all the business systems of a school district more effectively. And that's our goal, and that's why we're very enthusiastic about this proposal, because it has the support of the entire school community, and it has our support because it allows us to do performance audits for school districts. I can see I haven't moved you particularly, but...
I think we've... I'll just represent the papers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you explain the history or why the legislature isn't the legislature may not be the client, but why isn't the legislature privy to any of the audit reports, or why aren't they issued to the, and what's the philosophy behind that?
Chair Jensen, Representative Edwards, I guess the philosophy is it certainly is shared when it's ready, when the report is done, when it's ready for public release. The last thing that we would want to do, or any auditor would want to do, would be to release information that's incorrect. And it's, though we like to paint auditing as some well-organized, pretty thing we do, it can be pretty confusing, and we quality assure everything we do, every finding, background information, everything that's in the report is quality assured. And that leads right up to the last minute, the last signature that the secretary gives, the response of the auditee. That's all considered and is a part of the quality assurance process. So at that moment in time, we're ready to go and ready to share with folks outside of the auditee circle. And the auditee circle is very, very restrictive. I mean, it's us and the auditee. And that's the information that's being shared, passed back and forth. So when it's ready, when we're absolutely sure the information is right, then we will release it to the public. And like I say, our biggest concern is that we don't want information out there that can be attributed to us that isn't correct.
Thank you. Representative Crumble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize also for beating this horse to death, but then we can dismount, I guess. When one of the criticisms of K-12 is performance of students, graduation rates, dropout rates, teacher performance, you know, and all of those sorts of things, what the administrators are doing and, you know, all of those sorts of things, why would you not include classroom performance in audits that are conducted and have them conducted by consultants with a background in education? I'm really at a loss here. I mean, I don't think we get to the crux of the problem, if there is a problem. And the other thing is, if I'm a school district administrator, I'd rather just contract with my firm that does my regular audits and say, I want you to include a performance audit.
Chair Jensen, Representative Crummel, I think you probably stated our issue on the education side. If we were to do classroom sort of education, would be a consultant that would probably be someone who we would engage to do that. Our expertise is on the operational side, and that would be where we would want to focus our efforts, and we think there are savings to be gained by that. And we have an interest. I mean, there's a lot of state money that goes to school districts. We think it's something we should be doing. That's what we do, is follow the state money. So to follow it to an area where we think we can provide very good information and do very good audit work seems like a good initial place to go. The education side of the equation is something that as you stated, would be, you'd have somebody with a different set of expertise, and it wouldn't necessarily be an audit that would have to be performed to do those sorts of things, but
if it's not included, then Bill, I won't get that.
Thank you. Let's move on now.
To the performance measures, sir?
I thought that's what we were on.
That is. Let's see. Chair Jensen, I believe we left off leading into performance measures, results, and changes, which was, I guess, page 4 of 105 or 106 in our section. The performance measures that we have had approved as external performance measures were those that were recommended by the National State Auditors Association. I did want to mention that at the time that happened, we were probably leaders in the state as we typically have been on, or leaders in the nation as we typically have been on performance measures in general. So at the time we had these things adopted, there wasn't a whole lot going on in other states around those types of measures. But what we did adopt are, let's see, number of the value of savings. The value of savings, well, let's just go right through to the performance measures themselves. The first performance measure is the audit costs per hour. This particular measure compares our costs to private sector costs based on contracts that we let every year. And so it would be, I think, very similar to the cost of the work if we would perform it. And as you can see, we consistently are below what we are paying our private sector auditors to do the audit work that we contract them to do. You might also notice that leading into the next biennium, we will be changing our charge rate. It will go up. As I alluded to yesterday, we did modify our salary matrix in hopes of retaining more people. We do have a young staff who we hope will stick around long enough to receive promotions and pay increases. So this will be leading in the next biennium, more likely than not, our charge rate. We haven't made that change yet, but that's certainly what we would anticipate. Let's see. Any other information you'd like about these targets before we move on to the next one? The next target, or the next performance measure, is the value of savings. This, as I stated in the first sentence, this really is just a simple display of one of the primary benefits of our audit work. When we're doing work that we intend on having identify savings or identify question costs, we like to try to quantify that and report it in some way. The focus of that work and the reason for quantifying isn't necessarily to show off. What we're trying to do is to provide information to the auditee, so when they're doing their own cost benefit around a recommendation that we are making and comparing that against what potentially they could save, it gives them that information. When they're doing the work, they would have to do that anyway, so to quantify that just seems like a natural next extension, and is also something we can provide to show the value of our work.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How often, and I guess this is all wrapped up, but how often do we repeat an audit, or do we repeat an audit, so that if you were to want to quantify how many of your recommendations for cost savings or efficiencies are taken and used, and evaluate that. Is that something that could ever be done?
Chair Jensen, Representative Beyer, the mechanism we use for that, particularly on the performance audit side, is following up on the recommendations. And you'll see one of the measures later on is the percentage of recommendations implemented. Initially, we've done the work. We've tried to quantify what the recommendation may bring in terms of savings. If the recommendation is implemented, then the implication would be that the savings would be garnered over time. So by tracking the recommendations and hopefully ensuring that they've been implemented, the savings should be realized. And on the performance audit side, they typically aren't recurring sorts of audits. On the financial side, they are, and we follow up on those recommendations.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. The third measure that we tend to use is audit dollar savings per dollar spent. Again, an economy and efficiency measure for us, for those projects that are dedicated to the performance sort of work. It's a simple math: what we're investing versus what we are identifying, and we tend to track that. And as I've stated with several of these, identifying a relevant target is difficult. We haven't had a whole lot of
of we tend to use kind of historical to identify a target for us. In this next interim, we will be revisiting a lot of these measures in terms of how best to set meaningful targets. And part of that exercise will be revisiting some of the other states that we are hopeful are using these sorts of measures and talking to them about how they set their targets to, again, find, if we're going to be measuring these things, I'd like to have really meaningful targets, or as meaningful as possible. And that's and that will be what this exercise will hopefully lead us to.
Sure.
Representative Edwards.
Clarification, audits, dollars savings per dollar spent. That's per dollar spent on the audit.
Correct.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I look at this one and the previous one that seemed to be very high in 05, is it that you did a number of a lot of audits, or were there particular audits that you really found big?
Chair Jensen, Representative Beyer, it is very cyclical, I don't know that I can explain it. During that year, we did have just a couple of audits that found significant savings. And if you'd like copies of those reports, I can provide them. I can't remember off the top what they were.
Was one of them the OTIA?
No.
Okay.
That would have not happened in that time period.
Okay.
What time frame?
05.
05. We just released the OTIA report, so it would show up in this cycle.
It was during the interim,
year.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. And
Senator Butchett?
Yes, please. Thank you. When you're talking about, I understand the dollars spent, the dollars saved, but aren't there some intangibles also in an audit, such as establishing best practices for other agencies and perhaps deterrence for other agencies to not fall into the same trap?
Chair Jensen, Senator Winsett, I agree wholeheartedly, and that's why I try not to hit these too hard. I mean, these are just one measures of productivity, but audits are broader than that. Audits are providing an assurance about or presenting the state of things regarding a particular question. If the question is worth asking, the answer should be worthy, whether it's good, bad, or ugly. We tend to focus some of our specialized performance audit works on those areas that are higher risk and potentially would have some savings to identify. But if we had a program that was important to look at for whatever reason, and we walked away saying things were fine, that probably has a high value, because this provides the assurance that things are working okay. And we recognize that. And this is not the only measure of what I consider our success to be. In fact, I'm not sure I would rank it near the top. And the fourth measure that we use, number of recommendations implemented, which Representative Beyer was asking a question about, we do track.
Read ahead.
We do have, I think, a fairly good success rate of having our recommendations implemented. As you can see, we set the target around 90%. We typically range in the 83 to 85% range. In a little bit of the research I've done, I did notice that the federal agency that does this type of work, the Governmental Accountability Office, does set their target at 82%, and sometimes they hit it, sometimes they don't. But so I think we're in the range of practical considerations. I did note in here that I don't think we would ever be at 100%, because we measure this as from the time we do the recommendation, you know, to a year later, has it been implemented? Well, some of our recommendations take longer than a year to implement. So we have established, or I'm starting to try to establish, a longer-term tracking as an internal measure, so that we don't lose sight of those other recommendations and continue to follow up on whether or not the older recommendations are implemented as well. And if a recommendation is worth making, it's worth following up on.
Mr. Chair. Representative Edwards.
Thank you. How do you guard against, or I guess one of my concerns with this performance measure would be it might encourage you to set the bar kind of low on recommendation. I mean, you would get a higher rating if you were recommending that, you know, little stuff, mm-hmm. little stuff that's not very, costly or that's not very tough politically to get done. And so could you speak to that a little bit?
Chair Jensen, Representative Edwards, I guess it just kind of boils down to our professionalism and us as professionals. And we certainly have a lot of folks involved who take what they do very seriously. So even if a specific team tended that way, which I wouldn't think they ever would, we would have our audit managers, our deputy, and myself looking at the types of recommendations we're making to ensure we're really getting to what it is that needs to be done to fix the program. So the only assurance I can really provide is that we know what we're doing, and hopefully we're making recommendations that really make sense from a lot of different points of view, but basically to fix what we've documented as being wrong. And if you read our reports and if we've adequately talked about the condition that exists in a given program, then the recommendation should fit very nicely. The reader should be able to understand why we made the recommendation we did based on what we saw.
I think that was a long description of how to say our professionalism.
I wouldn't disagree, Chair.
Thank you.
Let's see. So if that's those are our four external measures. To talk a little bit about our policy option packages, number 131 is the dedicated funding that may come to us from the passage of Senate Bill 47. The equivalent would be three full-time positions that if we could get the policy option package in the bill, that we would be able to probably identify specific folks who could learn education to the max and be our dedicated function on the education audits. Otherwise, if we got the funding and not the staff, we'd probably be in that position of sharing responsibility again internally, though we get the work done, but it would be more difficult to dedicate people to doing something like that full time. The second,
yeah. Senator Whitson.
Thank you. Mr. Hibner, are we looking here at seed money to get you up and running in school district, or is this are you thinking here along the lines of ongoing budget cycle after budget cycle infusion of general funds? Because it seems to me that if you're doing an audit on a school district, it's no different than an audit somewhere else. If you identify savings of a dollar for every dollar you charge, it didn't cost the school district anything. And all the ancillary parts of the audit then, the benefits of the audit, would accrue to the district without charge. So I'm not, is this seed money for to get you up and running, or is this going to be a general fund funded project?
Representative Jensen and Senator Whitsitt, I suspect that moving forward it would be attached more towards the state school fund and funding through the state school fund. So though the initial amount is $1 million, if we're showing the value, I would suspect that our part of that either would grow, we would be negotiating more amount, or would be asking for more amounts of the common school fund moving forward. So it, you know, we budget by biennium, so this could be the extent of it, but I suspect that if it follows a logical path, that we'd be continually asking for more and more funding from the common school fund for these sorts of school activities, these sorts of activities.
Follow up, please.
Follow up.
Why would you not charge the school district? Why do we need an extra source of funds here if your audits are actually, identifying savings dollar for dollar? And plus you have all the other ancillary benefits of the audit that would accrue to the district. Why would we keep pouring more money into it? Why would not the district be willing to pay you to save them money?
Chair Jensen, Senator Whitsitt, in effect, the school district is being charged. I mean, it's not necessarily dollar for dollar like you've stated. Mm-hmm. I think it follows similar to the model of the assessment. The sort of information that we gather from doing a specific audit and by releasing report publicly is implementable by everybody.
Is this going to be other fund money down the line then? Is this going to be referred to in your budget in future years as other fund money, not... It's going to come from general fund. Money. It's going to come, as we've asked about a bunch of other general funds, but it will be generally other fund money.
Mm-hmm.
That's correct. Is that the source of where you were at, Senator?
Yes, basically I'm saying, you know, that... Actually, it would be other funds if it came from the district.
Yeah.
But the difference is that we'd be putting more money into it one way, and the other way it would be self-sustaining, as I see it.
Yeah.
On the one hand, we're putting more money in the top, and whereas in the if the school district is actually paying for the audit, which benefits them and others, but it benefits them, then it really wouldn't be costing them anything as long as Mr. Hibner's minions go out and find more savings than they actually charge.
Yes. Mr. Chair, Senator Whitson, if you look at the model of how we pay for audits at the state level, we don't charge a specific agency for an audit. Every agency pays a fee, and we then decide which audits to do. The analogy would be, given that 65% of the support for local schools is coming from the commons or from the basic school support fund, that would be the source of funds that would be paid really by all of the schools as a payment from the school support fund, rather than going to a specific school district and billing them. We don't bill specific agencies for audits. And we're basically trying to take the same approach with local school districts, because it really makes sense to have an audit function at the school district level, where you're not going to be throwing local school districts' budgets completely out of whack when you do an audit on that specific school district.
That answers one of your questions. Why they don't sub it out to or farm it out to a...
Mm-hmm. Okay. If I might, Chair Jensen, just to correct for the record, and I don't like correcting my boss, but there are certain state agencies that are direct bill. They aren't included in the assessment because they are trust fund agencies, and they legally cannot be included in the assessment. So they're not a lot of them, but there's a certain percentage of our funding that comes from direct bill work. So, anyway, that's
good. Correct. Thank you for clarifying that, because I was just going to ask you, how is it that if it's audits are paid for out of assessments, why do you have an hourly billable rate? So thank you for clarifying.
I got that one clear.
Okay. And I do have another comment before we move, when we're at the end of okay. this particular piece,
okay.
before we move on to the next pop.
Before we move on to the next pop?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Are you ready to move on to the next pop?
I am.
I'm going to be really pretty upfront about this. First of all, I think with regards to these school audits, JLAC better have input into it. And I think that JLAC should be helping to set the parameters for what the audits are going to cover and what the anticipated outcomes are going to be. I also think that if you don't include the classroom teacher and administrator performance in this, it's wasted. And I see no purpose in it. And as far as taking it out of the state school fund, I think you're going to have a hard time wrestling that because we have education advocates in here all the time already telling us that there's not enough money for what they're doing already. And the last thing is that on this one, I would absolutely insist that the legislature is the client. That way the legislature is going to give you input, and they're going to know every step of the way through your reports to JLAC what's going on. Because there's nothing more frustrating than to have ordered an audit and can't get the information. And then we are basically notified at the same time that the general public is notified. We're getting calls from the press wanting to know what we think of these things and haven't even had a chance to read it ourselves. So I would absolutely insist that the legislature is the client in this case. And I think in future audits, Mr. Chair, that we order as a legislature for whatever it is, I think we need to put language in the bill that states that the legislature is the client. Therefore, the legislature has the ability to get and be privileged to the information. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
Mr. Chair.
Representative, please.
I would just a comment. I would suggest that the client actually, would be the taxpayers and the students and communities that we're ostensibly doing all of this for. So, yeah, we can be the client, but ultimately it's actually the taxpayers are the client. Thank you.
R.E., the term representative.
Chair Jensen, I'm certainly the interest is there. We know it's there, and we're certainly delighted that there's broad interest in the work that we do. And when we list people who are interested, customers for our work product, certainly the legislature, taxpayers, and everybody is right at the top of that. And I know that Representative Krimmel have had this discussion before, and I'd be happy to have further discussions on these matters as we see this bill move forward and school audits move forward. I think those would be productive discussions. So I wouldn't mind having more thoughts on how we can incorporate the interests of the legislature in this sort of work.
Mr. Chair, I just have one quick comment, and I'm going to disagree a little bit because I think there's value in any audit you do. I don't think that if you're not looking at one specific thing, that doesn't devalue what else you're looking at. So I think that I disagree on that piece. I think there's value in looking at the operations side. And there probably is value looking at the other, but I don't know that they have to be done together.
Okay, thank you, Representative.
Okay, our next policy option package, number 132, is a reclassification. We've incorporated into the duties of our office manager those duties of a training and development specialist, also a part-time database administrator, and she helps us with some of our other work in that area. So what we're trying to do is better align what the needs of our office are by changing that particular position to incorporate those duties.
And I assume that's it.
Yeah, and other than the efficiencies, if you'd rather me not go into that, then we're done.
I think... unless there's a heartburn on that, Peter is being shorted as you speak, and that's going to mean that he isn't subjected to the same scrutiny that you have been subjected to.
That's fine.
And we wouldn't want to deprive anyone of that.
Thank you, Chair Jensen. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Peter.
Mr. Chair, I guess I should say for the record, Bill Bradbury, Secretary of State, I wanted to just introduce Peter. He started his career working actually in the private sector at U.S. Bank and then was the information resources manager for 3 years at DCBS in the Workers' Compensation Division. And he's now, he's been director of the Corporations Division for the last 5 years, and I wake up at least once a week and thank all the forces that exist that Peter is working for us, and I think it has been a real significant benefit for the morale at the Corporations Division, and the performance of the division has been really dramatically improved with Peter's presence. So.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary.
Thank you. Chair Jensen, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Peter Threlkill. I'm the director of the Corporation Division for the Secretary of State's office. The Corporation Division assists the public in starting and registering businesses in Oregon. We file public notices of records of debt. We train and commission notary publics, and we investigate notary complaints. We also provide certifications of records and notarized documents. We provide access to the public to public record information to allow the public to know whom they are doing business with, and we provide information on how to become a notary public, how to start a business, or how to hire employees in Oregon. The division is funded entirely from fees paid by the public to conduct filing and public records transactions with us. We operate with a staff of 36 employees, and we transfer over $17 million in excess revenue to the general fund every biennium. The division is adapting to the Internet age. This is where customers expect immediate access, fast response, and 24/7 availability of services. We're using technology to develop better and faster ways to receive customer filing information and to streamline the process of registering a business with multiple government agencies in Oregon. To that, we are leading the effort working with the Departments of Revenue, Employment, and Consumer and Business Services to create and expand the Central Business Registry.
Senator Johnson.
I'm delighted to hear you say that you're working collaboratively with these other agencies. I just had a constituent issue come to my attention wherein the constituent was uninformed or failed to inform herself about the requirement to pay personal property taxes. And the question that occurs to me as I've tried to undo this problem is the relationship between your office and the Department of Revenue and for these new business people that are coming in, setting up corporations for the first time, is there a portal in your systems whereby such a person would understand the responsibilities attendant with setting up a corporation?
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, the couple of things that I believe address that currently. We have two Oregon business guides, one on starting a business and one on hiring employees. And we've worked with the Department of Revenue and the other departments to really create these over the years. And they have quite a bit of extensive information about the requirements for taxation and personal property. We also have a lot of that information is available online through our website in our Business Wizard. And that's a process. It's a directed interview where the public would go through. They'll answer a few brief questions about their location, about their business, about their business organization, and whether they have employees or not, some other information as well. And then what they get back is a long list of referrals to the different agencies that they may need to talk to. Go back and follow up where there may be some regulatory requirements and responsibilities for them.
Mr. Chair,
follow up.
Is the Business Wizard voluntary, or do you guys, when someone files their requisite paperwork with you, do you nudge them in that direction? How would one ordinarily come in contact with your publications or the Business Wizard? I think the Business Wizard sounds great.
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, it is voluntary. It is something that we get about 300,000 phone calls a biennium from the public, and a lot of them are people that are very new to starting a business, and they get a hold of our number and they want to know what are the things that I need to do. And one of the things that we always refer them to is the Business Wizard. So. We're getting about 36,000 people going through and completing the wizard every year.
One last question. I'm going to have responsibility later in this session in dealing with Oregon Economic and Community Development's budget. And with all of the emphasis on growing our own new businesses, I'm trying to find those connect points between your office and OECDD that puts the right tools in an entrepreneur's hands in order to legally form themselves, to have the right documents that you would require, and then to have these portals into expertise that's reposited in other places. And I am either looking, in my question to you this morning, I'm either looking for reassurance from you that such connections exist, or if not, can we strengthen those connections? Because it seems to me that if you haven't done the legal paperwork to get yourself incorporated and to do all the things that you need to do to be an established business, the chance of success probably diminishes. And I'm just trying to figure out how do we link those up so we're not just handing out these little kind of vague grants and say, go forth and make jobs in a business, but rather we lay the tools into someone's hands to know that they're properly organized and filed and all that good stuff.
We already provide referrals to economic development. Probably a closer partner for us is the Small Business Development Centers that are located in various counties. And these are a great asset to the business community. We love to make referrals to them. They provide hands-on training for people that are new and starting a business in all the different aspects of what they need to know to become more expert in the functions that they're doing, whether it's marketing or employment issues, taxation issues, those sorts of things. So those are things that we currently provide, and we're always looking for better ways to enhance and provide better services there. You know, it's not something that we do a lot ourselves, is we don't have that expertise in our staff, but we reach out to those that do have the expertise and try to get them in contact with the people that need to work with them and need that help.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Please proceed.
From my place? Okay. So with the Central Business Registry, the system is currently available, and it can be used by the public to register a business name with the Secretary of State's office. Work is underway right now to expand the capability to allow registration for business entities such as corporations, limited liability companies, and we're also working with our partners at Revenue Employment and DCBS to set up registration for their combined employer programs. So when somebody is going to be an employer, they're going to have withholding taxes, they're going to have payroll taxes, they need to register with those agencies, and our system will be handling that in the near future here. Continued funding for an expansion and development of this effort is requested in POP 172, so I'll make that plug as we go along, and we'll come back and discuss that a little bit later. Offering services through the Internet allows the public greater access to our public record information. Prior to putting our business registration system online, the public requested 300,000 business information requests a year. They now request and receive over 3 million requests a year through the online site. We've seen similar growth in our Uniform Commercial Code program, where when the public had to come to us, they came about 18,000 times a year. Now they go online over 200,000 times a year to get the information they're looking for without ever having to call us or talk to us or wait for us to get back to them. In addition to public record searches on the Internet, we now anticipate providing online training to over 5,000 notaries a year. This is a new system that went live last July 1st, we've trained a little over 2,600 notaries so far through the online training program. It provides the information that the notary needs to know, or the applicant needs to know, to become a notary. It administers and scores the state-required test to become a notary, and it delivers a certificate of completion to the notary, all without any staff interaction or intervention. As I mentioned earlier, we have over 36,000 business registered interviews conducted every year. Again, these all mostly completed without any of our staff intervention. One of the things that we do offer, though, is the opportunity to give us a call, to send us an email when people have more questions, and a lot of people do take advantage of that. Because our customers do want to receive timely and efficient and personalized service. Our customers place a high value on the ability to speak to a real and knowledgeable person. So we view expansion of electronic services delivered over the Internet as a way to enhance and supplement the services that we provide, not to eliminate those personal services offered by telephone and in person. I would like to talk a little bit about our move into our performance measures. And our first one is performance measure number 6, and that is e-government services. As I've mentioned, with POP 172, we're using strategic technology investments to automate our service delivery by increasing the number of e-government services that we make available to the public. Each electronic government service represents a manual process that has been automated for customer self-service over the Internet. We currently offer 16 e-government services and anticipate adding another 6 this biennium. The targets that we set we're based on a presumption of continued funding for POP 172. I realize that's a little bit backward from the way this process is intended to work, so we may need to make some adjustments there as we go forward. While we think this is a good measure to track the growth of electronic government services, I have to admit at some point here the division is going to run out of processes to automate, and probably a better way to look at this would be to transition into measuring the percentage of transactions that are filed or conducted electronically. So that would be something that we would come back and propose as a new measure to really take the place of this one as we sort of hit our capacity to automate. Were there any questions on that? And if not, then I'll move on to the next step. The next three, 7, 8, and 9, really deal with timely document processing. And while the division didn't meet any of our targets that we set for ourselves in 2006, I have to admit to having a lack of experience at setting realistic targets. We've used a lot of these measures for a number of years internally to track how we're doing and where we're going. But I think what we did is we'd set very aggressive targets, and a lot of them depended on an early implementation for some of our electronic filing applications that we'd planned. We also took some early staff reductions in anticipation of those early e-filing programs. So that kind of compounded our ability to really hit the targets. However, when we talked to our customers, 97% of them rated their satisfaction with our turnaround times is excellent or above average, and that applied in all three of the programs. We also compared with our peers in California, Nevada, New Mexico, Washington, and Wyoming, and we found that we are either on par or outperforming those peers. As we look at KPM 007, which deals with business registration documents, where we averaged 2.1 days, our peers were taking 15 days to process the same documents for their customers. In the notary public area, it took us an average of 3.3 days versus 8 days for our peer group. And on the uniform commercial code side, we matched the peer group at 2.4 days for processing. So I kind of lump those together because they really deal with a lot of the same things, but I'd happy to answer any questions that you might have on any one of those three measures.
Representative Galizio.
When you do the state comparator to the states, are those adjusted for population?
Chair Jensen, Representative Galizio, no. We didn't adjust. Basically what we did is we just called them up. And we said, you know, what's the oldest unprocessed document that you have for business registration or notary public or uniform commercial code that you have today? And in most cases, they were pretty upfront. We had one state that refused. You know, they said, we're at least 3 days, but they wouldn't tell us any more than that. So we gave them the benefit of the doubt, and we said that they were at 3 days when we did the comparison. So, you know, we did look more at our Western state counterparts. The state of California, you know, they have a much larger population, and I'm not sure how many staff. So, you know, it is a bit of an apples to oranges comparison. Some states have electronic filing that they use to speed their processes. I don't think we're all staffed on a per capita basis. I know in California, when we looked at it, if you wanted a limited liability company, you were going to wait 58 days for the state of California to respond, either that you had been approved or denied that application.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you. You're a target of opportunity for me to work on some other constituent stuff, but I think it has a broader application. How about businesses that are trying to register that may, and trying to comply with the law, may be operating out of their home and have legitimate security concerns about having physical addresses published? I don't know if you can enlighten my understanding of that. Somebody dealing in precious stones or precious metals, and they want to list a P.O. box as an incorporation point. Can you help me understand the arguments on both sides of that?
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson. Yeah, this is an issue that we've dealt with, and this is one of the big areas of concern, and it really gets into dealing with the public's need for privacy and the public's need or individuals' need for privacy and the public's need for transparency. The programs that we administer are really set up as public records programs so that the public and other businesses can know who they're doing business with. You know, we have a number of people that would like to be anonymous for various reasons. Some, I think, very valid security reasons. We have worked with the Attorney General. We have put in place rules to allow for a personal safety exemption when you have documented needs to shield that address. We never ask for a home address, but we also realize that a lot of people do conduct business out of their home. There may be some costs involved. It may be that somebody has to provide, use a UPS store or a storefront to provide a physical address. They may need to hire a professional registered agent to fill that purpose for them. If they provide a registered agent is required to have be a person that resides or a business that resides in Oregon with a physical address. Legal service, exactly. And that's really, I think, for most of the business entities, that's the piece that catches them up. We'll take a P.O. box for your mailing address if you're a corporation. We'll take that for officers. But when we get to the registered agent address, the law says we have to have a physical address. So, it might be an attorney, it might be an accountant, it could be an employer, an officer that didn't mind having that address out there. And it may not be where the business is actually located, but that's where you could serve legal process and comply with the law. So there's a number of avenues, but one of the things that does catch people up is they just have a general concern, and the Attorney General's requirements are that there has to be documented evidence. So they have had to have filed a police report. They have to have had maybe a restraining order, some different things that prove it's not just I want to be anonymous.
That's the personal safety exemption. It wouldn't be that I'm dealing in precious stones out of my home and I don't want to be Betsy's Better Jewelry up on your website and lead people to my home address. That wouldn't be enough of a personal exemption for safety.
Okay.
I'm asking.
My understanding, it wouldn't comply with what the Attorney General has set forth. Now, if they've made a police report, we would take the police report. We're not really getting into a lot of the specifics. There just has to have been some action on their part other than I have these concerns, and a lot of times they're valid concerns. But, we do have to follow the process. So
you're going to change your mode of operation now here for Betsy Jewelry?
Yeah, that's right. My sack of diamonds in the basement that I'm dealing with.
Were there any other questions on the timely performance measures? If not, I'll move on to the customer satisfaction measure, which is performance measure 13. This is something I'm very proud of, our staff. I think they do a great job. But I think it's a part of it is really the way that that we look at our customers, and you know, we believe that our customers are our best source of information on how to do things right. We get a lot of our best ideas directly from the customers, and we do that by listening to them. We conduct frequent surveys throughout the year, and anytime we'll pick a week at a time, and a customer that files a transaction with us, in their acknowledgement letter, we'll send out a one-page survey form and ask them to reply to that, and it's postage paid so that they can easily mail it back to us. When we've gone through and done this, and in the start of the biennium, we converted to the new system where we measure overall service, timeliness, accuracy, helpfulness, expertise, and information. I believe all of those in 2006, we were at 96% satisfaction or above. When we look at overall satisfaction, that is something that we've measured for since 2004. In 2004, customers rated us at 97%. That went up to 98% in 2005 and 96% again in 2006.
Could you turn the mic toward you just a little bit?
Thank you. You bet. We haven't done, been able to do any comparisons or benchmarking. That is one of the things that we expect to be able to do now that all state agencies are measuring and tracking their service, and we expect to be able to come back after this next year and provide a comparison about how we're doing against those other agencies. I'm not aware of a lot of other peers in other states that do customer service tracking at this point, but that's certainly something that we're willing to look into.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have any idea what percentage of returns you get on your survey?
Chair Jensen, Representative Beyer. I don't have that information with me, but I can get that and provide it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
Moving on to efficiencies, and the growth and development of electronic government services really plays a major role in our increasing our overall operating efficiency. Many of the e-government services that we've developed and implemented over the past several biennia have allowed us to both increase use and access to our services by the public and reduce and eliminate staff positions. The division has voluntarily decreased staff during the last decade from 44.5 FTE in 99-01 to 35.5 FTE this biennium. That's a 20% reduction. Over the same period of time, the annual workload volume of our business registration, notary public, and uniform commercial code programs has increased by 33%. So we have more work, fewer staff, and that equates out to a 66% increase in overall productivity since the beginning of the decade.
Do you have a plan to improve that?
The a lot of the Chair Jensen, a lot of the electronic e-government services that we have in POP 172, we believe, will allow us to continue those efforts. So as we're doing more electronic filing, we expect that that'll allow us to do our jobs faster, and provide faster service to the public. So we're always looking for ways to do things better and smarter and faster and cheaper. So, you know, that's very much a part of what we want to do.
That's fine. Yeah.
The next part was our program option packages. And we'd originally put together POP 151 because of concerns and issues that we have with our business information call center. This call center is located at Oregon State Correctional Institution, or OSCI. We We staff the telephones with inmate operators, and we have two of our own staff currently out there that manage and supervise that program. We were looking to increase, add one other supervisor position and increase and reclass one position to a manager position for increased accountability and coverage, also to provide better oversight for the inmate operators. In the time since we've put this proposal out there, we've continued to work with the Department of Corrections, and we've come up with a joint solution that we feel really addresses all of the concerns that we have and really eliminates the need for this POP at this time. It is something that we have included in the 2% cut package that Jean Strait will discuss during her part of the presentation. And then on POP 152, which is designed to help us protect public records from identity theft. Over the last few years, we've all heard about the growth and increase of identity theft. We've all heard about databases that have been hacked into, laptops that contain Social Security numbers that have been stolen. And I'd first like to state for the record that our databases do not contain any Social Security numbers, and we never put Social Security numbers on laptops. Where we do have Social Security numbers is in some of the public record documents. And we have millions of pages of public record documents that we're the custodian of. ORS, Oregon's public record law, ORS 192, guarantees every person the right to inspect these records. Where we have that information currently, we don't have any good legal authority to prevent someone from coming and looking at that information. In most cases, the information is required in our farm products program. We follow the federal regulations, and the feds have always required that the creditors get the Social Security number of the debtor, and they put it on the filing, and that's submitted to us. And when it comes to us, it becomes a public record that anybody can then come and look at. This has been an area of concern for us. We have introduced House Bill 2090, which does a couple of things. It eliminates the need to collect or for filers to transmit those Social Security numbers to us. And it also gives us the ability to black out or redact Social Security numbers when we're providing public record information. So we can do our part to help and protect those individuals from the potential of having their identity theft or, you know, being subject to identity theft. We're not aware of any instances nationwide where a public record has been used to conduct identity theft, but we don't really want to wait around until we're the test case or the ones that are on the newspaper as having been culpable in that. So what we're doing here, we're asking for two positions. Those positions will go through our new documents that are filed with us, and they'll be going through all the millions of pages of documents that we currently have filed. They'll go through a process to redact that information so that when it is made available, we can be very certain that the Social Security numbers are not included. We have some cases where in our Uniform Commercial Code program, Oregon has never asked for Social Security numbers. The states of North Dakota and South Dakota do. They're the only two states in the nation that do. UCC uses a national form, and unfortunately, the other 48 states were never able to convince North Dakota and South Dakota to remove that box from the form. So we have a lot of secured party filers. They see it on the form, they fill it out. And, you know, we don't have in our UCC law the ability to reject those filings. It's something I'd like to have. And, you know, we'd be able to help train people that way and stop them from providing this information into public record. So,
okay, please, yeah.
Mr. Chair, just the juxtaposition of the, you know, staffing the business information call center with the inmates and the talk of identity theft. I have to ask a couple questions. you know, ostensibly you could have somebody who's in jail for identity theft who's manning the call center. Is that accurate?
Chair Jensen, Representative Gleason, no, that is not accurate.
Okay, good.
all of the inmates that go through, that are hired to work for us in the call center, do go through a screening process. One of the very first things that are looked at are what crimes they're incarcerated for. The very first thing that they're eliminated for consideration of is fraud or identity theft. So none of the inmates that work for us have those convictions. There's also a number of criteria.
Is the cell facility that they occupy sometimes with other inmates so taken into consideration?
Chair Jensen, it is a prison, so I'm sure they're exposed to those sorts of individuals. I don't know that roommate situations get into anything that they're looking at. We never ask for Social Security numbers on the phone. We really try not to ask for that information. So one thing about the call center. Every phone call is recorded and is available for review later. Our staff that are out there, a big portion of their time is spent monitoring phone calls. So they're listening in live and monitoring the call that the inmate is having with the member of the public. So, you know, we take that very seriously. So, but the inmates, you know, do not have access to any documents that might have a Social Security number on them. It's not on any of the screens that they would have access to. So we have to provide them certain tools so that they can, you know, provide the information to the public and do their job. But they do go through quite a bit of training, and they are watched very closely.
Follow-up.
Two questions. Have you ever been out to one of these? Have you seen... you know, visited one of these call centers? And then secondly, how many supervisors are there per inmate or customer service representative?
Chair Jensen, Representative Galizio. Yes, I have been out to the call center to OSCI a number of times. And we have two of our staff are currently there that and they're supervising, listening into, monitoring the calls and working with and training the inmates. Department of Corrections prefers that we refer to them as inmates and not operators or customers. So
not important. But so how many? So two supervisors.
We generally have we work with a pool of inmates so that but generally, we have about eight inmates staffed out there at a time, so 2-8 ratio. That does get up to as high as 12 or 14 at different peak times.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Byer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to go back to the form. I think I missed part of the conversation on that. The which form that comes from North Carolina, or can you kind of go back over that with me?
Chair Jensen, Representative Byer. It's the Uniform Commercial Code National Form. So this is the it's a form that was developed nationally. I believe it came out of NACUSL and was endorsed by them. And the Uniform Commercial Code Program is really a set of 50 state laws that are designed to allow a business, and its whole design is to create uniformity from state to state, so that a business that's operating in multiple states, they don't have to come in and learn all new laws in a new state. And so they'll come in, and the national form is available. Oregon has their own form, and we've blacked out that section where the Social Security number box has been. You know, we're continually going back to the states of North Dakota and South Dakota and asking them why, you know, and can't they, but, you know, they have to go to their legislature to get that changed as well. So, and because it's a form that can be used for 50 states, it was included to try to accommodate as many states as possible. It just does create some unintended consequences for the rest of us. If we had the ability to reject a filing that had that information on there, then we'd have a pretty good solution, because we'd send it back to the secured party. If someone owes you money and you're trying to secure your position in line, if there's ever a bankruptcy, you want to be first in line or as close to it as possible. So timing is of the essence, and you don't want that rejected back to you. I think that would be a pretty effective tool to convince them to stop putting it on our form because Oregon doesn't want it. But we do go back to the people that file, and we beg and we plead, and we point out that these are public records, and what they're really doing is they're, you know, creating the potential to expose their customer, their debtor, to some sorts of fraud.
Okay.
And, you know, we try to appeal to them that way, but we're always looking for better solutions.
Thank you.
Okay. We're all done?
I'm done.
We're adjourned.